Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Klatch. I'm Marianne Russo, and along with Pierrette D'Entremont, Elise Butowski, and Jane Hotbet, we are the Coffee Klatch. Tonight we have two guest moderators on our chats, Barb Dietrich, Lorna D'Entremont, and Alex, also known as my bipolar son. So they'll be over on TweetChat for you to interact over there. We also have the Blog Talk Radio open chat room open tonight. If you prefer, you can join us there. And later in the program, probably about 9:45 Eastern time, we'll start taking your calls, and I will give you the number at that time. A little disclaimer, the statements and comments are those of the guest alone and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Coffee Klatch. So tonight, we have Susan Resko, the Executive Director of the Child and Adolescent Bipolar Foundation, and we are thrilled. This is a very misunderstood disorder, and, you know, parents are really struggling to raise these children with bipolar disorder. So let me introduce our guest, Susan Resko. How are you, Susan?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Terrific. Thank you for coming. Susan, you were given the life unexpected when you had a son with bipolar disorder. And, you know, I had read that you were not familiar with mental illness. So can you tell us a little bit about the Child and Adolescent Bipolar Foundation and, you know, how you help the, you know, newly diagnosed families?
Sure. Well, my story is like one of thousands. I came to CABF as a mother of a newly diagnosed child, not knowing anything about mental illness or bipolar disorder in children. And I just read a lot and connected with a lot of other moms on the website and just tried to understand this illness and the best ways that I could do, you know, help my son. And I was volunteering at first and then got involved as development director on staff and then became executive director about 4 years ago.
And, you know, the Child and Adolescent Bipolar Foundation is really an advocacy foundation.
Right. It's information, support, and advocacy.
Well, why don't we get started a little bit? You know, we'll start with some of the basics. You know, I wanted to speak a little bit about, you know, the diagnosis because, you know, children oftentimes have different presentations than adults. I mean, you know, there are some children that have, you know, the very episodic ups and downs of bipolar, but I think a lot of kids present differently. They have more of a chronic agitation and irritability. So, you know, what is the criteria for diagnosis, and at about what age can a child be diagnosed with bipolar disorder?
Well, I don't think there's any one set age. It is difficult the younger the child to get an accurate diagnosis, but that's true for a whole host of psychiatric illnesses in children. I think if there is a strong family history and the child presents with very clear episodes of mania, that certainly makes it easier. But it's not an easy diagnosis to give to children, and it shouldn't be done in one visit. It should be done over a number of visits and in consultation with a number of doctors. And a lot of that people don't have the ability to see doctors more than one time because of location or their ability to pay. So when I say that, that's really the ideal situation. But as a lot of our families know, we take what we can get. And often that times that means one doctor's visit every 3 or 4 months.
Wow. I mean, really, that's got to be so difficult to, you know, make that diagnosis in such a small child because, you know, with the comorbidity, I mean, you very rarely find children with these neurobiological disorders or mental illnesses that don't have comorbidity. And, you know, there are some sensory or pervasive or OCD type, you know, issues that can cause a child to, you know, to rage. So, you know, it must be difficult to really get the definitive diagnosis.
Well, it really is difficult for a number of reasons. One being that the children have immature emotional systems, so they're not able to articulate the feelings that they have or their thoughts in a way that an adult would. They're also developmental beings, so that what may look like bipolar one visit may look like ADHD another visit, because their bodies and their emotional systems are changing. So I think the important thing for parents to understand is that it's not uncommon for a child's diagnosis to change, but that doesn't mean that they're getting necessarily bad care. There's a lot of reasons why children's diagnoses can change over time, and it's not always the fault of the doctor. There's a lot of factors that go into why these diagnoses change.
Absolutely. And, you know, the child being able to, explain what they're feeling and, you know, why they're feeling it. And, you know, the parents also, I mean, it could take, you know, like you said, a very long time. It could take years to,
mm-hmm.
you know, see the sleeping patterns and the different triggers and, you know, the
right.
causes to these problems. So, you know, it is difficult. You know, I know I'd like you to address, I know that, you know, I think it's a misconception that there's been a tremendous rise in the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children. So, you know, how do you feel about that?
Well, there has been definitely an increase in the rate of diagnoses. There was a study done in 2007 that showed a 40-fold increase. Now, the question is why? That's the million-dollar question.
Right.
Some people say that 40-fold increase, that was on top of almost nothing. So when you look at a 40-fold increase on top of nothing, it puts it in perspective. Other people say, bipolar disorder in children, it's sort of a catch-all for a lot of behavior that some doctors don't really know what it is, and they'll call it bipolar NOS, which is short for not otherwise specified.
Right.
And it's meant to convey a very serious illness, but they're not totally sure if it's bipolar disorder or not, which is why they would call it NOS. Other people say, well, the reason that the rate has increased so rapidly is that we didn't know to look for it before, a decade ago.
Right.
So it may have been there all along. We just never, you know, we never knew what we were looking for. Nobody really knows the answer to that. I suspect it's probably a little bit of each. But, you know, I'm hopeful that over the next 3 to 5 years, we'll start to get some answers. On the one hand, if a child is very severely ill and unable to function at home or at school, a bipolar diagnosis can provide that child with access to treatment and access to services that would not otherwise happen. On the other hand, it is a lifelong illness. So parents should be willing to relook at that diagnosis as the child matures, to see if it still fits. If it doesn't fit down the road, the good news is there might be some treatments that could change, and the child may not be saddled with that illness for the rest of their lives. On the other hand, it may not change. So there's just a lot that we don't know yet about how doctors are diagnosing children in community settings and how closely they're following the criteria in the DSM-IV.
Right. And, you know, also, education is going to be very important. And we're definitely going to get into, you know, educating a bipolar child. But, you know, what I'm
mm-hmm.
referring to now is we really need to educate everyone that, I mean, this is a serious, potentially fatal illness. And, you know, these children deserve as much respect and compassion as any other seriously chronically ill child. And I think that, you know, that sometimes is the problem because, you know, there is the stigma. And I think that, you know, parents have, you know, guilt or shame, and I mean that just really has to stop. Because
well,
you know,
these children
need help and they need support, and so do the parents.
You couldn't be more right. It's so stigmatizing, and so many parents will say, you know, if it was cancer, people would understand. People would bring casseroles, and they would set up carpools and
absolutely.
Prayer chains. And cancer is a life-threatening illness, just like bipolar disorder, but nobody understands what it's like and the agony that parents go through. So,
and, you know, the parents also have, I mean, these children, many of them need these medications. And, you know, the way that they're presented in the media as these powerful, you know, mind-altering,
mm-hmm.
you know, psychotic medications, what they don't understand is that this is not a decision that parents take lightly. And, you know, that's another stigma that needs to change for these children, because some of these children really need these medications just to function.
You're
so
right.
It's very,
some of
it's
the
very
children definitely need the medication. But children also need access to therapy and school-based interventions. Unfortunately, some children don't have access to those types of medications. So I think the media looks at kids that don't get those types of treatment and say, well, you're just medicating your children. It's very glib, and it doesn't really look at the problem. The reason why a lot of children don't get therapeutic interventions is because their insurance doesn't pay for it,
well,
or there's no therapist
absolutely.
In the area. So there's
and, you know,
a lot
there are,
of reasons why.
There are a lot of more benign approaches that obviously should be tried first with very young children. Like
mm-hmm.
you said, therapies and, you know, very simple, basic things, you know, that should be tried first. But, you know, like you said, I mean, the mental health care in this country is a national disgrace. I mean,
right.
you know, how does a parent go about getting quality care for their child? I mean, you know, what would you tell a parent coming to you? You know, given the fact that, you know, health insurance is a huge problem for families with mental illness.
Well, it's important to check with other families, and one of the services that we provide is people can put in their zip code and look in a radius around their home to find healthcare providers in their area, and then they can see how other families have rated those providers and the comments that people have about the various providers, and they can go on our message boards and our chats and ask other families, what do I need to do to look for a doctor? We've got a lot of documents that help educate families about what to look for in a doctor and how to get started and what's the best course of action.
And what do you see happening in our upcoming healthcare bill? You know, what do you see coming with Congress, and do you see any changes, you know, coming to, you know, help these families?
Well, I think we first need to digest the healthcare bill. Some of the things that I think are really great for our families are the fact that we can keep children on our insurance until the age of 26, because so oftentimes
I didn't know
children,
that. That's great.
Yeah, so that's a really great thing, because unless they were a full-time student or
mm-hmm.
You know, a couple of other caveats, children needed to go off their parents' health care plan at the age of 21 or 22, depending on the policy.
Right.
So that was a real hardship for families whose children were not able to stay in school full time or were not in school. But a lot of our children are not ready to leave the home in the traditional time frame, and they need health care insurance. And as we know, these medications and these the therapies are very expensive. So.
Mm-hmm.
For those kids that need to stay on their parents' plan, it's a wonderful addition that we have. As far as the other parts of the health care bill, I'm still waiting to see how it all shakes out, because, as you know, it's a lengthy document, and I'm still, you know, I'm reading different things every couple of weeks about interpretations. So I'm not really. I
know
really
my daughter's
qualified.
Doctor goes down to Washington quite often, at least once a month, and he's working on this bill. And one thing that he says is that, you know, it's not just our voices. I mean, the parents and you know, advocates really need to call their legislators and let them know what the needs are. So,
absolutely.
You know, that's just something I want to get out there too. But, you know, before they go into adulthood, I mean, educating these children is so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're very bright. It has nothing to do with intelligence, but, you know, they're just, you know, they're so dysregulated. So, you know, and what would you say a good IEP would look like for a bipolar child or teen?
Well, I think it varies as often as the child varies. So it depends on the particular child's needs and where they're needing more accommodations. Some children have learning disabilities in conjunction with bipolar disorder, so they'll need help tutoring or, you know, to be pulled out of a classroom to get extra instruction. Other children may not need that, but they need to be in a smaller class setting because too much noise and too many kids and too much stress will trigger their emotions. So it really depends on the child. On our website, we have an education corner with some tips for how parents can go through the IEP process. It explains what a child's right is and how to advocate effectively for children in the school setting. But it's hard for me to say what an ideal IEP looks like since every child is so unique.
Right. Well, you know, there's a special ed redirected funds that I was reading about. And, you know, from what I read, there are millions of dollars available to these districts. So, you know, what I don't know is what services can that be used for? I mean, could that be used for sending these children to a private school, which would be, you know, a more appropriate setting? Could this funding be used for a boarding school or a residential program if needed?
Well, again, I think it depends on the particular child, and I'm not sure exactly which funds you're talking about, but when a child is not able to function in a mainstream setting, they are entitled to a free and appropriate education. So that may not, the appropriate education may not be in the mainstream setting. And oftentimes schools will provide for tuition to either a cooperative special education school, or in some, you know, cases where the child's not able to live at home, a residential setting. But it's very difficult to obtain that type of education because it is so expensive.
And, you know, that's the problem, too, because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the residential programs really are substandard, and the better quality facilities where the child is going to get better and is going to get the type of therapy that he needs is just ridiculous. I mean, a family can't afford this,
and there's long waiting lines. So yeah, it's
a very frustrating disorder to treat. You know, and
it is.
You know that's a hard thing.
Not
you know, and getting back to the medications, you know, you know, these children, the side effects that they have from these drugs and the adjustments and the weaning them on and the weaning them off, I mean, it's just so difficult. You know, do you feel that these medications work similarly in children as they do with adults? What do you see?
You know, the important thing to remember is that children are not little adults, and their bodies metabolize medications very differently than adults. We need a lot more studies on how these medications work in children. And it's you know, part of the healthcare system that we have is that first we try medications on adults, and we study them in adults, and then they're immediately tried on children before there's been adequate studies. So you know, it's just very important for families to keep detailed records.
Absolutely.
Many years would keep a journal in my kitchen and just write down notes for the next time I would talk to the doctor. But, you know, do your research, talk to other families, come to our forums and our chat rooms and ask. We've got a lot of very educated families who have been through this and are willing to share their knowledge.
You know, and being a medical historian, I actually, you know, had wrote about this, that it's just so key. And, I mean, I know that charting in school by the teachers is, you know, very important and very useful, but, you know, that's not what we're talking about here. You know, what we're talking about is a journal that you keep, and it's very important that, you know, parents journal the medications, the date that they tried it, the side effects, whether it was generic or brand. I mean, these things are very important because, you know, during the course of this disorder, you know, more than likely you're going to be switching psychiatrists or whoever is prescribing. And, you know, that is so key because when you're caught in the thick of it, when the child is manic, it's very difficult.
Well, and your memory
exactly
starts to blur over the years. It's hard to remember what worked and what didn't. And so if by writing it all down, that really helps the psychiatrist in understanding what works and what doesn't.
Exactly. And also, you know, your time is very limited when you're at, you know, these consults. So, you know, that's
right.
Just a very, you know, very important thing to remember. You know, I know that there are going to be some changes coming in the DSM, but, you know, I often wonder where this is going to land with, you know, bipolar for these kids, because in some ways it looks to me that this really is a continuum, like a spectrum, very similar to autism, where, you know, you have a very, you know, you have a lot of symptoms that are that can be on the range from mild to severe. And I know that, you know, the temper dysregulation disorder is being, you know, tossed around, that that's a possibility. Do you think that it's going to land on a continuum, or do you think it's going to be broken down into more specific disorders?
Well, all I can really tell you is what I've read. I have not read about anything with regard to a continuum within the DSM-5. Certainly they have proposed the temper dysregulation disorder, which, you know, some people think may help. I don't think it'll be the panacea. It may help, but I don't know that it will certainly address all the concerns that we have. You know, some people are advocating...
Well, what is the reasoning for that? Is that just really a bipolar NOS? I mean, what is the reasoning behind the temper dysphoric disorder?
Well, in some ways, I think it might be what some kids that are the bipolar NOS diagnosis now might fall into that TDD criteria. Basically, I think there was a concern that by this committee that children were being diagnosed with a lifelong illness and they weren't growing up to have bipolar disorder. So it was meant to capture those kids that looked very bipolar-like but were not having discrete episodes of mania, not irritability but just mania. And so it was suggested as an alternative, you know, maybe a wait-and-see period to see how these kids develop over time, with the hopes that researchers would study this group of kids, more researchers would, and come up with some appropriate treatments. And those treatments might be therapeutic in nature. They might be therapeutic combined with medicine. There's still a lot of unknowns right now, we're just waiting to see what the next steps will be.
Well, this is until 2013, so...
Yeah,
but still,
well,
they'll start doing
trials before that.
Right.
So on the one hand, I see it as being... there's good things about it, but as I said, it doesn't address all of the problems with the state of children's mental illness and treatment right now. Because if we just keep throwing more meds at these kids and the same meds, well, then all we're doing is changing the name, but we're not really changing the treatment.
Right.
So if they do more research on these kids and come up with better treatments, then that could be a good thing.
Well, is TDD specific to children, or is this still adult criteria?
It is specific to children, yes.
It will be specific for children. Okay.
Right. But that raises another question. What happens when a child turns 18 and they have a diagnosis of TDD? Then what happens after that? So there are still a lot of questions that remain about this diagnosis or this proposed diagnosis.
Right. And how does this affect accommodations then? Because would a child actually be classified by the school system, by the district, would they be classified with a disorder like TDD or bipolar? Would that give them more accommodations? I'm trying to think education-wise.
These are all, you know what, these are all great questions, and I've addressed that with some committee members. The APA, who is, authors of DSM, has said that they really, it's not within their purview to think about how the DSM is used beyond diagnosing illnesses.
Right there,
so how schools use it, how insurance, that's really not their within their authority.
Right.
But, of course, we all know that a lot of the DSM is used in a lot of other ways.
Absolutely.
So how schools will respond to this and how insurance companies will respond nobody has really, at least I haven't seen anything yet, but it's alarming.
I looked and I didn't find anything.
Yeah, it's alarming because we hope that that these kids, it's meant to convey a very serious illness. So one would hope that insurance companies and schools understand that. But I don't think anybody's,
that's the concern I have. I mean, I'm speaking, purely for myself. I mean, it doesn't seem like I'd like to see some forethought into how this is going to benefit these kids. Because like you said, you don't, this is a lifelong disorder, and these children change in presentations as things go along. So, I would just... I know we've made great gains in a short amount of time for these children,
mm-hmm.
but we've got a long way to go. Now getting back to that, getting back to the studies and the research, what alternative therapies are you finding? Because I know that we spoke a few weeks ago. We did a different show on bipolar, and we talked about thermal regulation and other things that could help these kids, and sleep regulation, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything that you've heard that helps these kids that besides medications?
Well, certainly it's very important to keep a good sleep schedule. I'm not talking about this from a research perspective, but because there's some people that are looking at bipolar disorder as sort of a circadian rhythm disorder, so that there might be something that's going on with the sleep cycle that's somehow interrupted and it's causing emotional outbursts. They're doing some work at Pittsburgh on this. So, but just intuitively, when a child doesn't get a good night's sleep, they're not going to feel well, any well child. So a child that has any kind of emotional dysregulation, it's just even more important to keep a good, regular sleep schedule and try to keep on a routine as much as possible, because it's more predictable for the children. They're less agitated. They're less thrown by changes in their routine. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
As far as other complementary and alternative treatments, they're working on studying, a lot of different omega-3s and flax seeds. And I try to stay up on this as best as I can. I have not heard that there's anything really definitive out there,
mm-hmm.
but they're still looking at trying to find some answers in
and,
complementary and alternative.
You know, no two are the same, and there's so many subgroups, and what may work for one doesn't work for another. So
that's right.
You know,
so if it's not costly, and it's been, and you've talked to your doctor, and the doctor said, you know, go ahead and try it, then, you know, you can't hurt. What I get concerned about is when parents spend thousands and thousands of dollars on unproven therapies that really have no basis, and their doctors convince them that this is, you know, something that they really ought to try. And that's where I encourage families to come to our website and to talk to other families before getting involved with things that are not proven. It's just do your research and talk to your doctor, and if something doesn't sound right, then, you know, check it out and get a second opinion.
Right, because, you know, even though it could be benign, if it's going to make you take 10 steps backwards and put you into more financial ruin, you know, it's really something
right.
you need to think about. You know, also what I wanted to discuss with you was, you know, a lot of these children, unfortunately, from time to time have to be hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, suicide is, you know, is a reality for these families.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very, very young children, and this is something I think people don't understand, and I don't know the statistics. I know that we just had the National Suicide Lifeline was on with AFSP last week.
Oh, right.
That was a great session that we had. And, you know, people don't realize that very young children can have suicidal thoughts and attempts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're unfortunately, these children sometimes do need to be hospitalized. So, you know, usually these children are hospitalized for very short periods of time, like 3 to 5 days. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, what support do you have for a family that, let's just say, the child is hospitalized and then the hospital wants to release them and they have an unstable child?
Mm-hmm. Well, the hospital really is at the mercy of the insurance companies and how many days the insurance will cover. So it's important as a parent, even if this doesn't seem like it's a remote possibility for your child, understand what your policy covers. Call your insurance company if you have any questions and just know what you have available to you. Talk to your doctor and ask what hospital he or she would recommend in the event that a hospitalization is required. Talk to other families in the area. You know, go to our website again and look and read about various hospitals and parents' experiences with them. No two families are going to have the same experience with a hospital, but you can, as you do your research, you can get a sense, and it's just something to have to tuck away in the back of your mind,
right?
Because these things often can come up very quickly, and you want to be prepared, and you want to try to remain as calm as possible and have all of your ducks in a row, so to speak, if you get in that situation.
Exactly, and you know, I know a lot of parents get concerned that they don't want to raise, you know, any red flags, but it really is smart to be proactive and to have a plan in effect if you do have a child that, you know, does cycle into mania.
It really is.
Do you
and
find
a lot
that
of times
it's seasonal also?
Do
you find
a
that?
Lot
I know
of
I've heard
parents,
parents say that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of parents say that it is seasonal. Again, I think it's an individual thing with the child, but that seems, anecdotally, there seems to be a lot of talk that, you know, the springtime seems to be especially difficult.
Right. Which would bring me back, because, you know, my interest for the past 10 years has been the organic basis of mental illness,
mm-hmm.
and depression. And, you know, I really feel that there's some type of an immunological component to this, which is why the, you know, the fall and the spring for these kids to predominantly cycle just seems to me that there has to be some type of an immunological allergic type of situation going on. I mean, what else really could account for it, unless it's the time change, too?
Well, you know, it makes, intuitively, it makes a lot of sense. I haven't read anything to validate that, but I'm always, like I say, it's all if it makes sense to just slow things down in the spring for your child, maybe not sign them up for an extra class or activity. If you know that they're going to have a difficult time, then just go with it. It's not worth it to try to push your child if you know that certain times of the year are just going to be more stressful for them.
Well, you know, that's why I think, you know, the Child and Adolescent Bipolar Foundation is really such a resource for parents because, you know, a lot of parents don't understand that, you know, there are these different factors that are going on. They're new to this. They're devastated. You know, their homes are, you know, dysfunctional for periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would like for you to tell us a little bit about the programs that you offer because, you know, these parents really do need training. And,
sure.
You know, what I like about your program is that, you know, you understand that oftentimes these parents can't just, you know, go out one night a week to a session.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you offer to these parents and then also tell us about what you offer for these kids and the siblings because, you know, the siblings really need support too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, our website has a lot of information about bipolar disorder and we try to stick with the information that's scientifically credible rather than opinions or things that are not proven because we want to maintain a very credible site and we rely on the advice of our scientific advisory council and I regularly talk with various members to ask them what they think about this study or that study. And so we'll post that whenever we have reprint permission or we'll post links. And so we welcome parents to just come into our library and read, and they can read for days and weeks. There's so much information. We also have a family response team, so if a parent is looking for a doctor or they don't even know where to start, they can reach out to the family response team and somebody in their area will call or email them and kind of guide them through the resources that are available in their area or if there is a specific issue that the child may have, they'll try to connect them with knowledgeable professionals. And we have over two dozen online support groups. So as you said, parents can't always get out of the house with an unstable child and go to a local community center on Tuesday nights at 7:30, but
exactly.
They can chat with their friends online, and so we have various support groups for families. For example, if families are homeschooling or if they have bipolar themselves and they also have a child with bipolar disorder or various location-based support groups, and families can connect with each other. We have forums, so you can just go in and go out and ask a quick question or go in and read. There's blogs by parents that talk about various issues that we face.
Do you advocate for the kids at the schools? You know, like, because it's important to get the schools on board. You know, I mean, there's some
mm-hmm.
children, like you said, seasonally or just, you know, these kids cycle for, you know, different times for no reason. You know, they may need homework exemptions. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of these children, and not just, you know, bipolar, I mean, autism and a lot of other OCD,
right.
A lot of mental illnesses and neurobiological disorders are homeschooled because the schools really just can't educate them. They don't have the accommodations for them.
Right.
We
don't provide any direct consultation. We don't provide any direct consultation, but what we do is we have a number of documents that show parents step by step how to advocate for their children in school or how to find somebody in their area that can help them do that. But the types of things
that's very difficult, you know, too, because there's such a long list
yeah.
of people looking for advocates to help them
right.
through this, you know, educational maze. So, you know, but it is important that the parents are familiar at least with the, you know, the technical terms, you know, in the IEP.
The technical terms and what's within their rights and what's
exactly.
not. How
because
to work, we
really
advocate.
Don't know. Right.
Right. And we talk about the importance of collaborating with the school as much as possible, but then when you get to a point where the school is not, you know, following the law, then what steps you can do to take further action. So it's a how-to guide rather than providing one-on-one consultation.
Right. Well, you know, that's really the first step is to, you know, educate the parents so they can make informed decisions. And it also is going to give them peace of mind and not feel so alone because, you know, having a child with a mental illness is very, very isolating.
It is.
So, you know, you really do provide a fantastic resource for parents.
Well, it makes families realize that they're not so alone. And just because people don't talk about it, and a lot of times they keep it, you know, behind closed doors because of the stigma, through the internet, families can reach out and connect with one another, and they don't feel so alone, and they become better informed of how to help their children.
Right. Well, let me give the call-in number. Like I said, this is the first time we're doing this, and as I told Susan, I am no Larry King, so I'm hoping that if you call in, I do press the right buttons. But the call-in number is 646-595-2881. Again, that's 646-595-2881. If you have any questions for Susan, please call in. You know, what do you see as the biggest misconception about child and adolescent bipolar disorder?
The biggest, well, there's, I think, a number of misconceptions. There's still a lot of people that don't believe that it can exist in childhood or that it's vastly overdiagnosed and that it's the sad diagnosis.
People think it's an excuse, which is just horrific.
Well, you know, everybody comes to this from their different frames of reference and their different perspectives, or, you know, some doctors may have a practice where they have three families that come in and say, my child's bipolar and you need to give them a diagnosis, or, you know. So everybody comes to it from different points of view, but I think that the real difficult thing for any mental illness is it's still based on observation of a cluster of symptoms. And until we can find the genetic underpinnings and we can do a cheek swab or a blood test or a brain scan, we're still going to be fighting this stigma. And there is a lot of work that's being done on the research front to try to find answers so that we can have some biomarkers.
What research is being done? Like mm-hmm. you said, you know, genetics, biomarkers, you know, what's being done and how close are we to finding some answers?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know if I can predict when we'll find answers, but there's a lot of work being done on neuroimaging. And as of today, we cannot diagnose anybody based on a brain scan. It's still only being able to be used for research purposes, but I would say, you know, maybe within a decade, we will get to the point where we'll be able to look at a brain and say, this brain looks like it is acting in a way consistent with those that are bipolar or those that have anxiety or depression or what have you. So it's still not here yet, but that it's coming, and that's really exciting. And then there's others that are looking at the genes, and we don't think it's a single gene. We know it's not a single gene, and it's really a cluster of genes that increase your the likelihood. But we also know that there's an environmental component. So that just because you have the genes doesn't mean you're going to get the illness. There's something environmentally also comes into play, such as traumatic loss or stress or any other, you know, host of reasons why these genes turn on in certain ways and in certain people.
Yeah, because there does seem to be some type of trigger for some of these kids.
In some kids, yeah, and in other families say that their children acted this way
oddity
in the
birth.
Womb,
right.
And they were completely different from any other child, and they just were never calm and never
Absolutely.
Settled as a baby. So,
and, you know, that's where I think we're going to find different we have a caller coming in, so I don't want to put them on hold too long, but, you know, that's also where I think we're going to find different types. Like, you know, you're going to have the anxiety driven bipolar or the OCD driven, because, you know, you see a lot of these kids. I hear a lot of these kids that had these presentations very young, had different presentations, but wound up being lumped into this bipolar. But let's take this call now. Let's see who's calling in. Oh, what happened? I told you. Hello, welcome to the Coffee Clatch. How can I have? Do you have a question for Susan?
Marianne, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
It's Barb.
Hi, Barb.
I have a question for you that maybe you could go over with our parents, Susan, and that is, what are some of the differentiating markers they look for in bipolar versus things like anxiety disorder, OCD, things of that nature? Because it seems to me that many of these diagnoses are come to by process of elimination. Can you speak to that a bit?
Well, you know, I'm not a doctor, so I can't tell you how to make, you know, they make a diagnosis, but I can tell you that there's criteria in the DSM-IV for these various illnesses, and it's based on a cluster of symptoms. So if a child has depression, they need to meet certain criteria for depression, those, you know, being sad, irritable, withdrawing from pleasurable activities, you know, the grades may fall, they may withdraw from friends, and if this happens for longer than a two-week period of time and you see enough of these symptoms, then the doctor will feel that they can make the diagnosis for depression. And now with bipolar disorder, you have to take the depression and then add in the mania. And if the doctor feels that that there's enough criteria to them that are met, then they'll go ahead and make the diagnosis. But again, it is a practice, and doctors, it's based on their experience and their judgment. So what one doctor may say looks like bipolar disorder, another doctor may not agree. And even the experts can disagree in children. That gets back to the issue that it's just very difficult.
Okay, that kind of confirms what I thought. It seems a little more almost subjective in assessing. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think that's a little bit simplified because these doctors are trained for years and they have lots of experience doing this. But there is no blood test. There is no biomarker. So it is based on observation of a cluster of symptoms.
Do you find, Susan, that there are any gender differences in presentation? Do you find that, you know, girls possibly present more with depression, or are there any differences?
Well, bipolar disorder is there's not one gender that is more likely to get it, but the interesting thing I've read that more boys are diagnosed than girls, and so I don't really understand, you know, why that is, but I have read that.
More boys are diagnosed with ADHD than girls, too.
Right.
And, you know,
maybe the boys just are more disruptive and they tend to act out on their feelings, where girls tend to internalize. You know, those are generalizations, but that may be part of it.
Right. And, you know, the good thing is that there are a lot of, you know, support for these kids now. I mean, I know, well, I'll speak for myself. I live in New York, and I know that there is, you know, a lot of help for these kids. I don't know about, you know, the more rural areas. But, you know, also, you know, I wanted to talk about, you know, what good things do we have coming? I mean, what do you see on the horizon for these kids and these families that, you know, are giving hope for better treatment?
Well, the whole, you know, the debate about whether children are being overdiagnosed is causing more and more people to look at this. And so anytime you have more research or more people looking at that, I am optimistic that you're going to find more answers. If you've got just a few people thinking and looking at it, then it's not as good as if, you know, hundreds and thousands of people are looking at a situation. So as hard as it is for families to hear the debate, and sometimes it makes families feel even more demoralized and isolated when they hear things that there's this debate about the overdiagnosis, I try to look at the positive and say, if more people are looking at the problem, then we'll be that much closer to a solution. So the fact that it is getting a lot of publicity in press, I think ultimately will be a good thing. I think that the debate about whether we're over-medicating our kids can be a good thing, because then it will encourage those that have therapeutic interventions to study those and to come up with ways. Go ahead.
The studies that are going on that we were speaking about earlier, what are they looking for? You said that they're trying to find different presentations and different types of symptoms in these kids. You know, do you know anything that's going on that they're looking for other than genetics? You know, how are they trying to classify these kids and find out really what's going on with them?
You mean in terms of a biomarker or the research, just researching?
Well, we were talking about how they're going to be, you know, starting studies on these kids to look for the TDD and other diagnostic criteria. Do you know what they're looking for?
No, I don't. I know that they're going to start, you know, clinical trials, but I don't know the specifics of what they'll be looking for. I'm anxious to hear as much as you are.
Right.
And we'll be posting
it
on our website.
You know, it's funny because when you do the searches, you know, to see what's up and coming on this, you know, it's really, there's not much that I'm finding that's really looking for anything other than medication trials. So, you know, that's what I'd be interesting to see. I'm sure that
there are some studies that are being done on therapeutic interventions.
Terrific.
At Ohio State University, Mary Freistadt is doing a lot of work, and David Michalowicz out in Colorado is doing work on this. So, you know, there is work.
Well, that's good
in
to
that
know, because that's
well.
Really where we're going to start finding some answers. I have some questions here from the chat room. My bipolar son is asking, he says, one of the hardest aspects of bipolar is the hereditary link. Parents are frequently ill-equipped to deal with bipolar children. How does a parent that may be affected, you know, what services or what should they do so that they're able to deal with these children?
If a parent lives with bipolar disorder as well.
Right.
Well, I think, you know, to keep the household low stress as possible and to keep schedules very, you know, less chaotic, I think, is better, whether a parent lives with bipolar or not, because it's stressful enough for the kids to try to make sense of their baffling emotions. And
well, does CMEF provide support for these parents? Because, I mean, clearly, if they're
affected, it's very difficult.
They have to maintain their medications and keep themselves.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, when you're on a plane and they say, you know, put your air mask on first before your child, you know. It's very similar. You have to be whole to take care of this child. And he also raises another question here, which is that many of the parents that he deals with that provide support are parents of adopted kids. Do you find that, that maybe for traumatic reasons or whatever, that a lot of children that are adopted have bipolar or have this diagnosis of a behavioral disorder?
You know, there are a number of families at CABF who are adoptive parents. And we've noticed this from the very beginning. I don't know why that is. It's puzzling. I mean, there's some theories about why, but nobody really knows why. But I think in the last survey we did, there was probably maybe, oh, I can't remember exactly, but in between 15 and 20% of our families were adoptive parents. So
yeah, that's pretty high.
We do have support groups for families that are parents that are adoptive parents because that presents its whole host of unique situations as well.
Do you offer any type of resources for parents that are homeschooling? Because, I mean, the rate is very high for
mm-hmm.
parents that are forced to homeschool. Do you offer any type of parenting courses for them or, you know, a guide for them to keep their child social?
Well, we have a support group for parents to homeschool, and it's very active. And I encourage anybody that's homeschooling to come check it out. It's a terrific group of parents, and they have share a lot of resources with each other.
You know, it's funny because, you know, I always, when I hear about, you know, bipolar and these other mental illnesses, and my child has a very severe anxiety disorder, it just, you know, it's such... You know, I keep thinking of autism, that, you know, these children are just so misunderstood. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
children with autism, children with mental illness. And, you know, there's just so much there's so much that needs to be done for them. There's so much advocacy. And teaching these children to self-advocate is very important. You know,
it's
for them to
very
be
important
able to
and
communicate.
Very difficult.
It's very difficult, but, you know, they need the tools.
Mm-hmm.
Calming techniques, calming tools, and they need to be taught these tools before they're in a, you know, a manic state so that they can try, you know, these calming techniques. But, you know, it just seems that, you know, there's just so much that needs to be done, you know, for these children. So,
well,
you know,
and the one thing that I can say to parents about that is that they don't get frustrated because as children develop and they grow and they mature, they may not be able to understand how to do that at age 8 or at age 10.
Oh, no, I'm talking about as teens, as they
but,
get older.
Yeah, as they get older, they each year they learn a little bit more, and it gets easier for them. So don't give up, and as frustrating as it might seem, just know that things, you know, just keep at it, and things can get much better.
And, you know, keeping yourself whole is very important also for the parents. And I know it's very difficult, but, you know, it's so important
that,
you know, parents take care of themselves physically and emotionally so that, you know, they can be whole to take care of these children.
Even if it means going out for a five-minute walk around the block or...
Exactly. Jump in the car, put on your favorite CD.
Yeah. Yeah, just something to help clear your head and make you feel like yourself again.
Well, I thank you for coming. I mean, I know that we only have a few minutes left, but I did want to just touch upon, you know, the siblings. I think the
mm-hmm.
siblings sort of get lost sometimes.
Yeah.
And do you offer support, anything for the siblings? Because that's got to be so tough.
We do have some sibling chats that we've held, and it is a very difficult situation for families, because on the one hand, the child with bipolar disorder needs so much attention and so much more than the other siblings, but it takes a tremendous toll on those other siblings, especially if they're younger and they don't understand what's happening. A lot of times, the siblings can be you know, at risk for being physically harmed. So there's a lot of just horrible things that parents need to think about that don't usually, you know, most parents wouldn't even dream of thinking about. But the important thing is that you need to make sure that everybody's safe. And if you are worried about the safety of your other children, try to think of creative ways that you can keep everybody safe, whether that means a relative or a friend comes over. You can check with community mental health centers to see if they have any mentoring services for the bipolar child.
Respite
care.
Very difficult
yeah.
to get, but
it is a tough situation. I find that with my other children that are not living with the illness, though, they have a greater sense of compassion and understanding for kids with differences. And, you know, I think that's just living in a household with, you know, with their brother who they love, and they've seen him struggle so much.
Right.
I see that they, you know.
They see that it's an illness, yeah.
Yeah, there are.
You know,
it's
important to have quality time with the with the siblings. You know, away, even separate vacations. I mean, there's nothing wrong with leaving, you know, the child home with an aunt or an uncle or a qualified caregiver and going away with the non affected sibling. You know,
right.
It's important to keep the whole family whole. But
and even if it's just dinner and going out for dinner, you
exactly.
can get a babysitter. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
For discussing your programs, because you are a wonderful foundation, and we do want to spotlight you. And it is Mental Health May,
mm-hmm.
so we're very glad that you came on. And if
you
have any updates, please let us know. We'd love to have you come back on.
All right. I'll enjoy that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And at the end of the show, every day, you are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. Thank you for joining us on the Coffee Clatch, and we will see you tomorrow. Good night.